Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Hey, everybody, this is Ben. And before we start the show today, I just want to give advanced warning. This is a pretty tough episode about Star Trek The Next Generation that we're talking about in this episode. There is a sexual assault that is depicted more or less graphically on screen in the episode we discuss. So I just want anybody who has particular sensitivities around that to know that going in. And with that, I guess we'll get on with the show and see how we do with probably the hardest episode we've ever had to try to make jokes about.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet. Engage.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation, a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
Hey, Adam. How you doing?
I'm all right, Ben. How are you?
I'm good. I'm kind of riding high. We just had an important business meeting, you and I.
Oh, yeah. Just
discussing big plans for 2017.
I got to break the spine of my Robert's Rules of Order book that I keep handy for meetings like that.
Mm-hmm.
You did an excellent job of reading the last meeting's minutes, Ben.
It's really hard to get a second when you move to adjourn a topic when there's only two people and the other person disagrees with you on just about everything.
Right. I have to be your proxy for all of those.
Yeah, it's tough.
And that makes it awkward.
Yeah. But I'm excited because we've got a tour and Greatest Gen Con, and we're going to try and do both of them this year.
Yeah, our viewers have not been shy about reaching out and saying, look, guys, enough with the jokes about Greatest Gen Con 2017. We actually want it, and that is not a joke. And so now we've got to do it, don't we?
Yeah, I think we would rightly be excommunicated from our own podcast if we didn't deliver on Greatest Gen Con 2017 at this point.
They asked for it. We're delivering.
Yeah, we like literally don't even know when or where yet. It's a lot.
Yeah, so very productive meeting.
A lot to hammer down, but I think we made the strongest yet affirmative commitment to put the process in motion.
Yeah, another thing we discussed was the specter of the cruise, which is another thing that I feel like we're confident in wanting to attempt to do, but we have just as many details on that as we do on anything else. So I guess the bottom line is we have achieved some sort of forward momentum on all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So so wait to give up hope until we've actually failed at any of those prospects.
Exactly. Well, Adam, we're really into the brief Marin Open lately. So what do you say we get right into our episode that we came here to talk about today?
Yeah, it's the after-school special of Next Gen episodes, isn't it, Ben? It's season 5, episode 12, violations.
Now, this is an Uber mission, but we're not supposed to like Uber anymore, so... Boy, I don't even know what to say. Taxi cab mission?
They deleted the app from their phones.
Yeah, this is a...
I like the shorthand, though. The Uber is nice and tight.
Yeah, it's kind of become the Xerox of way to get from one place to another, hasn't it?
The Kleenex of ride sharing.
The Band-Aid of exploiting young people and people who are on the verge of falling out of the middle class.
The Tupperware of the working poor.
I can't think of another product that has...
Point Adam. Adam wins the volley.
You get nothing. You lose. Good day, sir.
You get me on a clay court, Ben. I'm sliding around all over the place.
Yeah. I'm used to playing on grass because I'm so fancy, Adam.
Right.
The entrepreneur is conveying some aliens.
You remember Uli?
To planet, and these are a type of telepathic historian. We've got Tarmin, the elder Ulian. He's got a kind of a heavy set older man with white hair, and his wife who rocks some serious like Princess Leia level hair braidage. And their son, Jev. And this is a type of alien with a really nasty-looking case of temple loaf.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
It's one of the grosser loafs, I want to say.
You really can't say enough about the wife's hair, which is sort of like a powdered wig, but if the wig was a noose... Sort of a powdered noose, I guess.
They got the same hair and makeup person that did Ensign Rose hair when she had the helicopter look.
It looks real tight. Like, uncomfortably tight.
Yeah. She's a pretty chill lady, though.
These Ulians walk around wearing these long robes that look like giant versions of, like, snowflake cutouts that kindergarten kids make for the holidays. Yeah.
I feel like this is something that would be on Project Runway, and they would really hate it.
Yeah.
They'd be like, you just used a standard trench coat pattern and then cut random triangles out of it. There's no creativity in that.
I think part of it might be that it just very clearly looks like felt. Just plain old white felt.
Well, maybe that wasn't evident in the standard definition edition.
Oh, it is so evident now, though.
Yeah, you see all the little fibers. The illusion is ruined by seeing all the little fibers.
So we get to know these Ulians during a kind of parlor trick that they play on Fair Keiko in a redress 10 forward, or maybe it might actually be 10 forward.
It's bitter.
There's something else inside the cup.
Yes, a wooden handle.
A spoon?
No, it's more delicate than that.
She's sitting at a table with the eldest Ulian, and she's got her eyes closed, and he's like prompting her. He's asking her about this cup of liquid.
Yeah.
That she can't get out of her head, that she's had it on her mind for a long time, and she just doesn't know what it's about. And so this is teaching the viewer about the power of the Ulians, using this example.
Yeah, and it kind of reminded me of a performance hypnotist. Have you ever been to one of those, Adam?
Yeah.
Where they have like a guy who's like one level below a stage magician.
It's real office party vibes, you know?
Right, yeah. Like we brought in Brian Sunderland to do hypnosis on the whole gang, so stick around.
You may have seen him at the Red Lion Hotel. Yeah. South of the airport.
Yeah. not in one of the ballrooms, in the lobby.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she's like going into deep memory and remembering a kind of a quotidian memory, right? It's just about being a little girl and helping her grandmother with a paintbrush, like getting some water so that her grandmother could clean her her watercolor paintbrush. And it's like, all right, I don't know what was so important about digging that up. Like, it's not like a trauma that Keiko has buried deep. I feel like all the trauma in Keiko's life is in the present.
Yeah, she's got real curly-haired trauma.
Yeah. She's in a loveless marriage. This is like one of the few scenes that we've seen with Keiko where she wasn't giving birth or having a fight with Chief O'Brien.
Yeah. Yeah, she's safe, finally. And this feels, I mean, once the parlor trick is over, you know, it's polite applause all around. Keiko has gotten to the center of her sense memory and sort of has solved that mystery. But
yeah,
it seems like the risks outweigh the rewards of doing this in public, right? So Keiko's only grasp of this memory is a cup of liquid.
That is remarkable. You remembered such vivid details.
But God, like, it could be anything. It could be Grandma's dentures.
Right.
For years, I've seen that old cup in my memory, but I could never remember what it was or why it was important.
And they just don't know until they get to it in a very public fashion. It seems like a very socially risky thing to do, in the same way that public hypnosis is socially risky.
Well, I think that, you know, yeah, like in a public hypnosis thing, there's always, they always kind of joke around with the crowd and play with the taboo of like getting a lady to take her top off or something. Like, they sort of imply that that's on the table as something that could be done when she's in this mind state, but then they don't actually do it.
Right.
But then they might, like, you know, get them to engage in some lighter form of ribaldry. I feel like Keiko is just squeaky clean, you know? Like, she looks into her past and she's like, there's nothing bad in the past, you know? Whereas, you know, if I had engaged in this, I have a rich history of embarrassing things in my past.
Sure. Sure. Some would say those are even happening right now.
And
they sort of they underscore that as they sort of throw it around the room after Keiko is done.
Perhaps someone else would care to try?
They sort of go around the horn with each other, and Riker's like, well, there's no way I would do that. And Geordi agrees, and so does Worf. Like, no one seems very hip to the idea.
Right.
The idea of going next, I should say.
Yeah, yeah. And Tarman turns to the doctor.
You, madam.
He kind of, like, baits her by kind of saying what she's thinking about.
You're thinking about that first childhood kiss.
And his compatriots kind of scold him.
No, you're not supposed to probe someone's memory unless they've given you permission.
And he says a classic rape culture line, which is,
you are right. But sometimes with a beautiful woman, I cannot help myself.
It is Trump on the bus kind of talk, but it's kind of laughed off by everybody, which is kind of strange, right? Because this is like supposed to be a future in which the kind of, you know, the sexes have achieved equality.
It should be terrifying.
Right. Like, they should be like, well, like, you guys are going to have to remain confined to your quarters for the remainder of the trip, because that's really not the kind of talk we tolerate around here.
And also, like, she would have had no idea that it was happening if he didn't say it. Like, he could just be playing around in her mind for the entire session and she wouldn't know, but it was his comment that made it clear that he was reading her.
Yeah, it is. It's like him forcing himself on her in the presence of a bunch of people, and everybody acts like it is like a pretty harmless and normal, okay thing.
They have to do it that way, right? Like, they have to set the tone that it begins innocent, because if it begins sinister, then the quote-unquote payoff isn't the same, right?
Like, yeah, well, and I think that
we have to assume innocence.
It's a weird head feint in terms of storytelling, too, because it's a very creepy thing that Tarman does, and something that I don't think would... Like, I think it's a bit of a miss in terms of something that would be an okay way to behave in the time that we're talking about. I mean, it's not even an okay way to behave now, but... But then they like end this scene with like a total like villain push in on Jev, you know, like they like let the music go all dissonant and push in on Jev, the handsome younger son, and it's like, well, I wonder who the villain's gonna be.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems fairly rare that we know exactly what's going to happen before the theme song drops. Like, it's not so much foreshadowing as it is very explicit forecoloring, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's like John Madden reaches into the frame and draws a circle around Jeff and goes, boom! Reset the observation lounge for a kind of a state dinner type situation. So, I don't know why Starfleet always has these big curved tables rolled out for when they're going to have like a big fancy dinner function.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when General Chang and the Enterprise crew had their big meeting.
I offer a toast. The undiscovered country.
What's nice about that curved table is that, it gives you an easy way to shoot it, like sightline wise.
Yeah.
It's great for the camera.
I guess so. Maybe it must be just because the ship is a circle, they have lots of arc-shaped rooms, and it would be awkward to have a straight table in there.
Everything's got to be D-shaped, right?
They want a nice easy D.
It's true. We don't get a lot of... we've seen dinner scenes on this show before that are very explicit about what's being... consumed. We don't really get a whole lot of that here. Instead, we concentrate on the conversation, which has to do with Tarman giving us more background on their abilities and how much training it takes to be able to do what it is that they do.
Right. So they're not like born into this ability. It's something that their species can do only with years and years of training. And these are like top of their tier professionals who have made a life of doing historical research by going into people's living memories with their permission. And so they're like traveling across the sector, you know, going planet to planet, like working on some kind of history project. And like, there's two kind of amazing things about this scene. One is that they, you know, they keep kind of pushing their agenda of doing this process on members of the crew. And the other thing is that the members of the crew are able to eat despite the fact that they're looking at the fucking loaf on these aliens, Adam.
Yeah.
You know how meatloaf looks great from like the top, but if you were to like break meatloaf in half, it gets like real lumpy and gross looking.
Yeah.
They got broken in half kind of meatloaf.
They their faces are very unappetizing.
Yeah. Yeah, and yet Picard and the rest of the gang are shoveling food into their faces.
During this dinner, Beverly's like, you know, Jean-Luc, this would be something that you specifically would be really into. As if Picard wasn't just a POW like a year ago and was responsible for the murder of potentially hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah.
Like, what kind of awful idea is that? That's the worst idea I've ever heard on this show. Like, let's go back into your memories, Picard.
Let's dig some shit up.
He might be the least suited for this sort of practice.
Yeah. And it's hard to tell whether the Doctor is kind of baiting him. Like, her tone is a little bit inscrutable, but it's... It is absolutely a strange thing for her to be suggesting.
Yeah. During this conversation, Tarman's like, yeah, well, I've been doing this for decades, so is my wife. But Jev, God, he's just an idiot. Like, we take him places and he doesn't know what he's doing. Like, he's a total embarrassment to everyone involved. And also, we hate him.
He tries to probe people and he doesn't even know what hole to put it into.
Yeah. Yeah, that Jev.
Once Jev spent 2 days with a contingent of elderly gentons. He couldn't get anything from them. I spent only 1 hour with them and retrieved a fragment from the Gentonian trade wars.
It's unprofessionally cruel.
It's do you ever watch The Deadliest Catch, Adam?
Sure, that's the show where they go catch all the crabs, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of dynamics like that where there'll be like an old salty crab captain and then his son is like out on deck and sucks at fishing for crab.
Right.
And the guy'll be like on the loudspeaker to the entire boat going like, my son can't throw a grappling hook worth a shit. That was sort of the vibe I was getting off Tarman in this scene.
The captain's like smoking 2 cigarettes at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Getting on the intercom.
Yeah, and then he like hits the button to alert the entire crew that a 50-foot wave is coming over the bow.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so Tarman's smoking cigarettes and making fun of Jev. Jev does that thing where he just leaves a formal dinner out of embarrassment. Yeah. And you know it's bad when you just get up in the middle of dinner and leave.
That's a move that I am prone to when I'm really upset. Not something I'm super proud of in myself, but
yeah.
I did really identify with just punching out of a stressful situation like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and Troy keys on this right away. And it's like, well, I guess I don't need to eat anymore either. I need to help propel this episode forward. I'm going to walk out with Jev.
Yeah, and so she hits the hallway with him, and they get on the elevator, and she's like, listen, like, I know all about having a fucking obnoxious parent.
They've made entire shows about my relationship to my parent.
Yeah.
And all of its viewers hate it.
There have been so many times when important fancy dinners in that room have gone really badly because of my mom. So I know where you're at right now, buddy.
And this is like, there are a lot of parts of this episode where someone being nice is mistaken as an invitation for some shit to go down. And Troy is just being nice. And Jev sees this as a reason to make her a target.
Right.
Like, in a super creepy way.
She's not just being nice, she's kind of serving her professional role in like helping him calm down.
Right.
And Jev acts like it's the end of the first date. It's he's like totally that creepy guy that thinks he's on a date when the girl doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she heads back to her quarters and
she switches
like,
into her sleeping ball gown.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, she's in like a floor-length taffeta nightie that's off of one of her shoulders.
It leaves everything to the imagination though, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah, you can't. It's not revealing of figure at all, Adam.
No.
She starts getting hit with telepathic bangers, and she's like trying to calm herself down, so she goes and gets a hot chocolate.
Hot chocolate.
But this series of bangers devolves into her having like a full-blown waking nightmare of Commander Riker forcing himself on her after a poker game.
I mustn't do this.
And in the midst of the chaos of this vision, Riker is replaced by the image of Jev.
Imzani, have you stopped thinking about us? Just answer that.
So it is pretty clear that Jev has invaded Troy's mind and is doing the telepathic equivalent of rape on her.
I'm going to assume that this scene was effective for you, just by saying this, but let's talk a little bit about why it is. It is terrifying to see someone we like do this to someone else we like.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You know, completely separate from the act itself, which is also terrifying. But
this is like the opposite of a mistake this show makes a lot, is
yeah.
They often will make the human collateral in a crisis something we have no connection to.
Yeah, and we are utterly connected to this.
Yeah, it's so, so upsetting. And, I mean, especially because of Riker and Troy's prior relationship, you know, I think that it, I can't imagine it doesn't feel like a really plausible scenario to any viewer who knows anything about date rape, you know?
Right.
And that's like the thing that is so upsetting about date rape to society, is that it is really hard to face the fact that men will force themselves on women that they're like nominally the lovers of, you know?
Right. Right. There are a couple of things that they do during the scene that amplifies how troubling it is. And one of the main ones is their use of cutaways. Like, mm-hmm. they are ISOing on all of the grabby hands, on eyes, and using quick cuts. You're getting far closer as a viewer to Deanna Troi than you ever have up until now also. So, like, not only is it awful from an act standpoint, but like as a viewer, you're being brought in just as close, just as intimately into that situation. Like I've never seen Deanna Troi's neck like in full screen before, but that's what we get. Like we're right in there in a way that is profoundly intimate and scary.
Yeah, and the hands grabbing like are shot so close up that it's a little hard to see what specifically they're grabbing, which is pretty shrewd television because it makes it, you know, as upsetting as your mind is willing to make it, you know?
I think there's another reason why we're discussing the scene so long, and that is because its runtime is long. Like,
yeah.
This is an extended assault scene on a show that I would say most fights in general, quote unquote fights, last two punches and then it's over. But this is like, this goes on and on.
Yeah. It's several minutes long. And in reading the capsule for this episode, in the last episode, I was thinking that this was going to be much more of a after school special tone, and this is pretty heavy stuff. Like it's not like, you know, I think that there's a lot of like valid discussion about how problematic it is to depict rape of any kind in media as a, you know, and there's, you know, I'm like not an expert on that, so I don't think that, and I don't think this is like the place to go into it on our hilarious comedy show, but for what it's worth, I think this episode deals with the issues in a way that is much more sophisticated than I remembered Star Trek being able to deal with things like this.
I completely agree. Yeah. I had expected, I mean, based on my memory of the episode, a more Night Terrors treatment of these events. And what we got was a far less campy, far more straight ahead depiction of this stuff in a way that it might have just been like in my youth. I wasn't able to grasp what this was in the way that I am now.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, and maybe like this is a little ahead of its time, even like maybe the kind of conversation about this stuff in pop culture has caught up to where this episode is.
Yeah.
To some extent. I don't know. Well, Troy wakes up in a coma, and the...
Do you want to take that one again? Because that doesn't make sense.
I was trying to have a joke in our show, Adam.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that was the opposite of a yes and, wasn't it?
That was a... there seems to be some mistake. They've got Troy in Six Bay, and she is passed out, and they don't know anything about what happened to her, you know. They are just assuming she's in some kind of a coma. So Riker winds up with the task of running the investigation, which I thought was surprising. Like, this is kind of Worf's job, but Riker is the one running around the ship, kind of looking into this situation, and the first person he talks to is Jev, and
that's a really interesting point in that, like, as the XO, Riker has sort of the diplomatic responsibilities, but where there's something criminal happening, you would think Worf would be the guy in charge, which I think really speaks to what the crew is perceiving, how the crew is perceiving what has happened. Like, right. they don't see it as a crime at this point.
Right. Well, and I guess also they are attempting to rule out the involvement of the Yulians, but they don't want to offend them in that process. So it's like, it's a little bit of like, hey, listen, this is kind of awkward to bring up, but ever since you've been on the ship... you know, ever since dinner last night, like, you were the person that left with Troy, and now she is not conscious, so that's kind of uncomfortable for us.
And I could understand that being the motivation if this were a different alien that we cared a little bit more about, but it doesn't feel like there are any stakes there for these people, because this is an Uber mission, and they're just taking these mind historians to and fro. Like, those stakes don't seem real to me. And at the time, it made me want to quarantine them immediately.
Yeah, yeah, like, put them in a shuttlecraft and tow them with the tractor beam. Get them out of here.
Right, right.
So, yeah, like, Riker tries to kind of connect with this guy, and Jev is pretty dismissive of the premise.
I'm not implying that you did anything intentional. I'm just trying to get to the bottom of the mystery.
We have nothing to hide. If you wish to spend time examining us.
Fine, thank you.
And there is another, like, totally insane villain push in on Jev as Riker leaves. And then we have a pretty touching scene with Riker back in Six Bay, just kind of talking to the unconscious Troy.
Yeah, he refers back to the clip show as a time where Troy talked to him when he was in a coma, and that, you know, that really seemed to help him, so he thought he'd give it a try with her.
Yeah, it's... And I think it's a really necessary scene, given how troubling it was to see him in the attack scene. Like, this kind of reminds us, like, what a good egg Riker is, you know?
Well, I think this scene is totally necessary for the reason you said, but also because this is something I wanted to circle around on when we finished the capsule, but how sure are we about which events did occur and which events were Jev's manipulation during any of the nightmares that drive the senior staff into comas?
Are you saying that he's actually physically doing something to them?
Edit this out if I'm completely wrong. But, like, are we to assume that Riker's date rape of Troy didn't happen?
I think it's all mental. I mean, that's what my understanding was.
My understanding was that it always started from a memory, from a real memory, that then was illuminated by the Yulians. And so there would have to be some truth to the memory at the core for a Yulian to manipulate. And so at this point in the episode, is there any reason for a viewer to think that Riker didn't assault Troy and that Jev's intention was just to take the place of the antagonist during one of the most emotionally fraught memories of a person's life? I guess there are two different types of nightmares that this could be that is unclear at this point. It's if Jev is placing the nightmare in someone's memory and it's a construction of his own design that he's done, or if he's merely becoming the nightmare that the person already has.
I 100% thought that Jev was inserting this into Troy's mind rather than remixing an actual memory. But
the reason for that is because the reason for that has to be because you know Riker would never do that, right? Is that the only reason a viewer has to think that it isn't a true memory? Because there's nothing plot-wise, there's nothing in the dialogue that says that that it isn't.
I don't know.
Is my interpretation just like reading way too much into it?
No, I mean, I think it's a really interesting question that I don't know that is actually answered in the... I mean, I never considered it, so I'm kind of reeling thinking about it, but it's...
Always felt like the Yulians needed something from the subject to craft the thing off of. And if... I guess which is... Yeah, I don't know. I have an incomplete thought about that, but...
Yeah, I mean, Here's what I'll say, like... And this is kind of, like, doing for a character what society often does for an individual in these circumstances is, like, we know Riker is a good guy, and I don't think that the show would make him a bad person in that way.
Right.
Like, I think that if we walk around for the rest of our lives thinking that Troy has a real memory of Riker forcing himself on her, like, that... Well, first of all, that completely undermines the main thing we know about Riker's sexuality, is that he is the number one consent aficionado in the universe.
Yeah. I mean, that really went to a dark place.
Yeah.
My love is a fever, longing still for that which longer nurseth the disease. Tell me more, you'll have to go again.
Speaking of going to dark places, Riker leaves Six Bay and starts having a waking nightmare of his own, and it's sort of like the cover of Rubber Soul, the Beatles record. He's in engineering, and there's some kind of coolant leak type situation.
Tell what he's doing there.
And they're bringing down the garage door, and... There's an ensign there that's telling Riker that bringing the garage door down is going to doom one of his compatriots to death. But he's got to do it. So it's like it's a dream about, you know, issuing a command that led to saving the ship but costing somebody their life.
The most troubling part of the scene to me was that the ensign looks so much like Ted Cruz.
That is, that's true. I think the most troubling part to me was that they didn't cut to Steve Zahn, you know, waist deep in water trying to shut off a valve as the as water flowed into the compartment.
Welcome back to Crimson Tidecast.
The moment this is over, Riker 2 wakes up in a coma.
everyone's just waking up in comas, Ben.
Yeah, no good.
He goes into his coma in about the most uncomfortable way possible physically. He only his head is on his desk. The mm-hmm. rest of his body is seated in a chair and hanging, dangling, if you will, below the desk. Yeah. It seems impossible as a position to hold if you're unconscious.
Yeah, it's sort of like that time that Wesley fell asleep with his nanites in the in the open configuration.
Yeah. Yeah, it does not look comfy.
No.
I am acute as a ball. You will assist us. I am acute as a ball. You are ball.
You know what you don't get in any of these scenes when the senior staff wakes up unconscious is is the gurney scene.
Oh yeah, like rushing them to the rushing them through the double doors to the ER.
You don't get that. I would have liked a gurney scene.
Mm.
That always really heightens the tension.
Yeah. And, you know, Picard knows from gurney scenes.
If you'd have fought one whit below your abilities, I'd have given you a good scar to remind you.
You get Barclay working on
That's a Dune reference, Adam. Dune reference.
See, I was just going to walk right by it, unregarded.
They've got like a couple of investigations in working in parallel now. Data and Geordi are going to work on seeing if there's like something in the past that could point the finger at these Yulians, and Dr. Crusher is trying to figure out if something is happening to the brains of people that the Yulians do investigations into. So she like brings Keiko O'Brien into Six Bay and gives her a brain scan, and Keiko is clear.
O'Brien's like, you're never gonna find anything in there.
Yeah. Keiko seemed a little gun shy in this scene, right? Like,
yeah.
Like Dr. Crusher's like, your readings come back normal, and Keiko's like, huh, is that okay? Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? What's going on?
Yeah. Yeah, and like Keiko's fine.
Yeah, she has nothing but good things to say about the hypnotist that they all went to.
Yeah. Yeah, if anything, she's like still super pumped about her dumb story with the brush glass.
Yeah. I one time like in college, I think like freshman orientation, they had some hypnotist show that we all went to. And walking back to my dormitory, I was chatting with a kid that lived on my floor who had gone on stage and gotten hypnotized. And I was like asking about it. And I saw him like a couple days later in the dining hall, and I was like talking to him about it again. And he said, yeah, it totally messed up my sleep. Like I couldn't fall asleep that night. It was like I had jet lag.
Weird.
Yeah. I wonder. So I just wonder whether Keiko is in her right mind, you know, because sometimes you say dumb stuff when you have jet lag.
I wonder how Keiko's sleeping the night after that.
Well, I mean, it's probably fine because I imagine O'Brien is out on the couch, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, she can spread out for sure.
So now it is the doctor's turn to have an upsetting waking memory. And this one for sure is a real memory, right?
That's just my argument, is that if the second and the third memory are based on real events, why shouldn't we believe that the first one is as well?
Well, is the second? Like, is that a scene that we've actually seen Riker go through?
I mean, we haven't seen him go through it, but it seems totally viable as something that would have happened at some point.
Yeah. I wonder. I mean, it does seem viable, but I also feel like we would have seen it, and it would have been more conclusive if it was like an actual thing that we remembered.
When you have nightmares, do you mostly have nightmares about things that have happened or about imagined things that have not?
I would say that typically it's imagined things.
Yeah?
Yeah. But that's a great point, right? Like, some nightmares are about things that happen to you and others are not. So
see, one line of dialogue could have cleared up all of this. If in the beginning at that dinner table scene when they're talking about the training, about how the Yulians do this, if Tarman or Jev was like, yeah, you know, like it all starts with a specific memory that someone has. Like, we can't work with anything that isn't already there. So it all starts with something that the subject gives us. Like, if we
but he's inserting himself into the memory. So if it's, I mean, if he can insert himself, who says he can't insert a memory?
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, I'm just trying to talk you out of Riker being a rapist here, but
believe me, I want to be talked out of that.
I think we all do, Adam. I think we all do. So, the doctor's memory is of going and seeing the deceased body of Jack Crusher, who, you know, I think we all know by now that Picard ordered Crusher to do something that ended in him buying the farm, and that is why the relationship between the captain and the doctor is so weird.
It's good of you to come.
It's the least I can do.
But Geordi and Data are like heading down to Six Bay to talk to the doctor, and they find her in a very similar position to Riker. Sleeping on her desk.
Data calls for an emergency medical team to Dr. Crusher's office, which made me think, like, how far away is that medical team from Six Bay?
Yeah.
Like, why wouldn't it be right outside in the hall?
Yeah, he should have just stuck his head out the door.
Yeah, that to me felt like an incongruity that I didn't quite understand. This scene, her memory, her nightmare was, I mean, no less shocking than anyone else's. I mean, you get to see Picard with hair. Mm-hmm. He's also wearing some sort of thing on his face.
Yeah.
What was that about? Was that to illustrate his own injuries that were related to Jack Crusher's that ended up killing him?
That occurred to me. I was also thinking maybe it's like some sort of cross-pollination with memories of after she treated him for the Borgs.
Yeah, I thought that as well. So, Ben, before we move on, like, what we have here are three awful nightmares, awful waking nightmares, where Jev has inserted himself in each one. In the first one, he is someone who is sexually assaulting Deanna Troi. In the second one, he is the ensign who is angry at Riker for killing a coworker in the line of duty. And in the third one, he has taken the place of Picard in escorting Beverly to view the body of her deceased husband. My question for you is, what is he getting out of that? What, like, Jev could be doing it because he has the power to do it, but, like, why?
You mean, like, why is his image in there also?
No, like, what satisfaction is he getting from the violence he's perpetrating on these people in their memories? Like, what we don't get is the cutback to him. Is he in? Is he in his quarters, like, totally jacked up on what this is getting him? Like, it's not like I want to empathize with him in any way, but I need a little bit more into his reasoning. Like, is it just totally? Is it the mind of a sociopath that you just can't explain, and so it needs no explanation as to why he would do it? But I don't know. It felt a little bit empty that this is happening and he's the cause, but I don't really understand why. Do you? And does that matter?
I guess, like, I mean, I don't think this completely clears that up, but I do get the feeling that he's sort of a guy who feels like he's entitled to more than he gets, and he's got this shitty father who publicly, you know, berates him.
Yeah, it's an act out, right?
It's and I mean, that's obviously not like an excuse or anything, but I do feel like I kind of see that as being maybe the recourse of a certain kind of person is to inflict their bad feelings on other people. And I also like, I mean, who knows when you've got this kind of power, like what the temptation is like, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you are sitting next to the laptop of a loved one and they've left their Facebook open, it's like hard for some people to resist the temptation of looking through it, right? And if everybody's mind is their, you know, is their password entered Facebook to you, that's yeah. gotta be, I mean, if, and like, if that is the case and you're also an asshole.
Yeah, I almost wonder if this was something that they, if this was a more intentional decision than we think, because if you see any pleasure derived from this form of violence, I think this becomes less quote unquote mind rape and more like actual rape in terms of its depiction. Like,
yeah,
I think the analogy turns real in a way that is probably not something they were willing to do on the show.
Yeah. And I think you have to assume that his attacks on Riker and the Doctor are about covering his tracks. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm not into his tactics, but I guess I can kind of see what's motivating them.
Yeah.
So at this point, Troy is up. She's recovered after 3 days in her coma.
She woke up from waking up in a coma?
Mm-hmm. They're still, like, trying to put everything together because she has no memory of what happened to her. Like, she doesn't even remember the assault. So they're like, hey, well, we've got these guys that look into people's memories. Why don't we have one of them look into it? And I guess that, like, Picard has, like, a conversation with the three Yulians in his office where they, like, convince him that this is the right way to go. And Jev kind of tosses himself out as, like, the one who's going to do it, which is pretty much the worst possible scenario, you know?
It's so fucked up to put the suspects in charge of investigating the crime, right?
Yeah.
It makes no sense.
And they don't even realize, like, what the crime is at this point. But they get started on this. And meanwhile, Geordi and Data are, like, trying to look into the idea that this may have happened before. So they're looking at the kind of travel patterns of the Yulians and whether people went into weird comas other times when these guys were around. So we have another very, very upsetting scene with Troy, like, reliving this memory. And, like, this is some of the most visceral and upsetting performance Marina Sirtis has done on the show, I think.
Like, yeah.
Like, she really connects to these very scary feelings. And
what really serves her well here is starting out positively. Like,
yeah, because
the memory
about
begins as a happy one and it totally twists into something awful.
Yeah. And thinking about that makes me Thinking about that fact makes me think that this is a fabricated memory, Adam, because
yeah.
I don't think that she looks back at this memory fondly at the beginning part of it if she knows what's coming.
It was a true assault. Yeah, yeah, you know what? You're right. Oh, God, I'm so relieved.
Woo! There was some genuine suspense in this episode, Adam.
Yeah.
So, Riker's good name is cleared by the way Troy thinks about a thing with him. and then the
seriously
memory.
That moment in our podcast might be more satisfying conclusion than the one we get on the actual show.
Yeah, I mean, because we do have to kind of like relive the trauma of a very traumatic scene. And it's Jev kind of bringing her back through the worst parts of this memory. And in the place of Riker, instead of Jev this time, it is Tarman. And so that implicates Tarman in the crime. And I think the next scene is like Jev and Picard in the ready room. And Jev is like, oh man, the old man really lost touch. He like is totally out of control. He's a really bad dude. And
good thing I was here to put him behind bars.
Right. Yeah. And meanwhile, Data and Geordi are still doing their cross reference. And by the time they've started to like put it all together, they realize that there's some coma victims on some of the planets the Yulians have visited that couldn't possibly have been Tarman's victims, because they went into comas when Tarman was back on the Yulian homeworld. So smash cut to Jev going down to say his goodbyes to Troy in her room, and he is about to force himself on her in her presence.
It's happening again.
You're so beautiful. So fragile.
It was you. It was always you.
This scene's pretty intense because she starts to fight back, but he, like, physically overpowers her. And it's, like, just in the nick of time that Worf and a Dustbuster Club come through the door, and like Worf kind of finishes the job that Troy started by like a open fist smack across his loaf.
Yeah, he one punch KOs him.
Yeah.
This was a fairly complex fight scene for Marina Sirtis, too.
Yeah, she really wails on the guy. Like, it's... She's definitely, like... You know, like, there's plenty of times when you see actors do stage combat where you can tell that they're holding back. Mm-hmm. And this is... And, like, when Worf comes in, it's clearly, like, a camera trick where Worf is throwing his fist past Jev, but mm-hmm. because he's a little bit back from where Jev is, like, you don't see that he wouldn't have really connected. I think Marina Sirtis is really, like, not holding back and actually throwing punches at this guy.
Yeah, she looks like she's really wailing on him, and it feels satisfying to see that.
You know,
not that the circumstance is fun at any point, but you like to see her get one over on him.
Right. Like, you like to see him start to get what he deserves. And it's also really amazing because in her mind, she's being overpowered by him, and he's, like, taken her communicator off her uniform and is starting to, like, grab her wrist, and she, like, wrenches her hand out of his and starts to kind of fight back a little bit. And you know, it's not like a fight that she has any hope of winning, but I mean, like, to the extent that there can be a catharsis for a situation like this, it is, like, sort of cathartic to see this guy get mollywopped by Worf.
Yeah. It ends sort of abruptly, right?
Yeah.
Like, the Enterprise changes course and takes the Yulians back home from whence they came. Tarman apologizes for Jev's awful fuck-up. And then off-screen, Riker and Crusher wake from their coma.
Yeah.
You know what's interesting about Riker and Crusher is that, like, we never get the sickbay scene of all three of them in the bio beds. We only ever see Troy with the blanket on her.
Yeah.
And so you never see, like, the visual stakes of this,
right,
like, in Compound.
Yeah, the last scene is just a really somber McLaughlin group.
Issue one.
Yeah.
I thought it was worth noting that the show goes ahead and calls this rape.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I think that there is probably a temptation when you're making a show like this to make everything be kind of metaphorical. Because, like, you know, science fiction is inevitably a metaphor for the present rather than an imagination of the future. Science fiction is always about us now and us thinking about, you know, who we are and where we're headed and that kind of thing. So the temptation to, like, let everybody do the math at home about, you know, whether this is rape or not is probably there, not just from, like, a we're making a sci-fi show standpoint, but from a, like, this is, like, a show that airs at 6 p.m.
right.
standpoint.
Yeah.
Like, this is a pretty heavy-duty topic, and, like, I don't think network television wades into these waters with this much delicacy very often.
Yeah.
Like this, I think this is like a real exploration of a real issue that affects a lot of people and one that is drenched in stigma and taboo.
Yeah. And, Marina Sirtis, like she was given something big to do storytelling wise, emotionally, and she did great.
She did so good.
Yeah.
It really underlines how underutilized she is as a performer in this show up to this point.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, she's had a couple episodes this season now where it's just crazy how good she is.
And
it just makes me feel so bad for all of the seasons where
she's kind of gone wasted.
Yeah.
Did you like the episode, Ben? I mean, to the degree that a story like this could be liked, there are ways to like this episode, I think we could agree.
Yes, I think it is like, as an artistic achievement and as an exploration of a tough subject, largely successful. I mean, like, I think that you also have to remember that it's from, like, 1991 or whatever. So, you know, like, I don't think it's as woke as the most woke ever exploration of an issue like this, but I think it's pretty solid, and the things that it sets out to achieve, I think it does achieve, you know?
Do you think Riker's the wokest of all the senior staff? Like, if we were going to do who's the most woke, it's probably him, right?
Adam, I don't feel qualified to call balls and strikes when it comes to wokeness.
Yeah. Maybe that's something we can keep an eye on going forward.
I think that's worth doing.
I'm with you, Ben. I mean, I quote-unquote like the episode because of its power, its relative power, especially. Yeah, it was strong stuff. Like, it was 100 proof Star Trek, for sure.
For sure. I'll be really interested to see the conversations that happen around this on the Greatest Gen online communities, because I think that we've already had plenty of, like, really insightful conversations, and I especially am curious to read what the women in our audience take away from this, because I think that it's kind of impossible as a, like, heterosexual dude to understand how scary something like this really is for women.
Yeah, absolutely.
Here's what I'll say. If you are going to wade into those conversations, please be cognizant of the touchiness of this subject and, like, try to be as respectful and conscientious as you possibly can.
As both of those things, as I think our viewers have been most of the time, I would expect
absolutely.
That.
Yeah. Well, Adam, all of that business taken care of.
Yeah, who's going to be our lucky Jumbotron person to follow this?
I think it is time to see if we have any Priority One messages.
priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Hey, Ben, we've got two personal priority one messages today.
That's my favorite size of priority one message.
Yeah, it's like four slices. You can totally take it down all by yourself.
Yeah, you can easily hold it in your lap at a ballpark or a movie theater.
Messages from Kathleen, and it is for Zonker Bonker. It's got to be a cat, right? All right, let's see if we can figure this out from the content of the message. It goes like this. Since the election, I've been donating to causes that make the world less bleak. The Greatest Generation is the rare thing that's made me laugh when I just want to cry. So thank you. Also, Zonker Bonker, if you're listening, thanks for introducing me to this podcast. I miss you, and my door is always open. Aww. Man.
So if Zonker Bonker is a cat, it's a hyper-intelligent cat that is capable of listening and understanding and even recommending podcasts.
We've gotten a couple P1 messages that are about, like, gratitude for introducing them to the pod. That's pretty great.
Gratitude is a beautiful emotion. I try to do some, like, gratitude mindfulness from time to time. I'm into it.
Kathleen mentioned something that I don't think we've mentioned too often on the show, which is we've heard from quite a few viewers about how great the pod is to listen to in a time of profound existential distress. So
yeah,
I don't think we're blind to what's happening, and I think for the same reasons that the show is being enjoyed, it is just as much of a joy and distraction for us to make. So I really appreciate hearing that.
Yeah, I always love those messages. We also have a message from Chris, and it is to Kat. Chris definitely sounds like might be a cat.
Kat definitely doesn't.
No, come on. Two on the nose. The message goes like this. Sorry for throwing a cool hundo at these nerds instead of our upcoming nuptials, but I'm doing it for us. They need to keep the show going and be convinced to continue with DS9 so we can see if they find Garrick and Bashir to be as gay for each other as we know them to be. Mm. Thanks for being the best dad to our cats. I can't wait to be married to you. Wait a second. How can there are cats explicitly mentioned in this, and Kat is the dad to the cats.
It's Chris's and Kat's all the way down.
Yeah, man. I feel like we kind of paved the way for confusing ourselves on this one, Adam.
I really love that Chris went rogue on wedding expenditures on this.
Yeah.
Ben, did you ever go rogue on a wedding expenditure? I'm trying to think of how I did. I know I did.
Well,
but it's hard. Like, you have a budget, and you have a list of things, but sometimes you just want to do something for you, and that's what Chris did here.
Yeah, I definitely did that when I went and got my my tuxedo stuff set up. Like, I splashed out a little bit on my raiments. But that said, I don't know that, like, clothes for groom was ever really a line item in our budget. So it was really just, like, me spending money on myself that I didn't really have to spend.
How upset would your bride-to-be have been if you had explicitly taken money from the wedding fund to spend on a P1 for a stupid Star Trek podcast? Pretty pissed, I imagine.
My wife is a lawyer. She's a... very vicious person when she needs to be. I just try to stay on her good side, you know?
Yeah, that's not a mistake you would ever make.
I like to dance around on the edge of her good side that is toward the eye-rolling side.
Yeah, that's fairly harmless, that eye-rolling side.
That's where I live. That's my neighborhood.
I love that the answer to a question, how would your wife feel, begins with, my wife is a lawyer. That's the greatest answer.
Yeah, well, I'm just trying to give the people context for what kind of rhetorical training she has for example, an argument about budget.
Well, congratulations on your upcoming nuptials, Kat and Chris. Hopefully this was not a reason to stray off course for those.
Yeah, and you know, if we get to Bashir and Garrick, we'll see if our gaydar goes off in the same way. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. We'll have to see.
No promises. One thing we can promise is to keep doing Priority One messages as long as they keep coming in. You can make sure that happens by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron, where personal messages and wedding announcements are $100. Commercial messages are $200, and they help us produce the show. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yarmouk and Jalad at Tanagra.
Are you looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. Every mom I have ever given an Aura frame to has absolutely loved it, and that includes a lot of moms I know. This is a gift that I have personally given many times, and it's great. I can upload photos from my phone the moment I take them. And that means that mom or grandma out there is going to get pictures of their loved ones delivered to their living room. And right now, Aura is having a great sale for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com, and use the code SCARVS at checkout to show your support for our show. Terms and conditions apply.
When I was growing up, I didn't have anyone to tell me about personal grooming. I had to learn these things on my own. So I'm here to save you some embarrassment and recommend the grooming tools that I use, the products from Manscaped. Now, this is a company that constantly has its mind on your bush. Imagine the meetings they have. Imagine the pictures they have in their PowerPoint presentations. Now imagine your junk looking its best thanks to the Lawnmower 5.0. This thing is the latest Bonch trimming technology, with two interchangeable heads, a standard one for taking just a little off the top, and a new foil blade to go smooth wherever your heart desires. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVS at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVS at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of TripleClick.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to... oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, Adam.
Did you find yourself a very special drunk Shimoda?
Incredible! Drunk Shimoda!
I did. There is a great Riker moment in that first scene where Tarman says his little line about not being able to resist with a beautiful woman that you just see disgust in Riker's disposition every moment after that after that line is uttered in that scene, his whole demeanor changes. And I just thought that was great. Like, I kind of, like, I thought that, like, we made up that joke. Like, I thought we made up the idea that Riker is more obsessed with consent than anything else about sex.
Yeah.
But now I feel like maybe Frakes made that up and made that part of his performance from the beginning.
Yeah. You read consent fetishist off of him in a nonverbal way, which is really fun.
It's great.
Yeah.
How about yourself? Did you have a Shimoda?
Well, Ben, I think our experience in production will help you understand what I mean when I'm talking about clearing a background. And, like, wherever you are, whether you're shooting an interview or you're shooting, like, in a big, wide open space, you want to be conscious of that background, don't you, Ben?
Sure.
Because you're not just looking at the person talking, you're looking at the person behind. And in the scene that I'm talking about specifically is that station where Geordi and Data are, they're doing the investigation. They're looking into the records to see all the places where the Yulians have visited and how that sort of matches up with people falling into a coma.
We're talking about the big set of computers at the back of the bridge.
Yeah, and so we're doing some shot reverse shot with Geordi and Data, but on Geordi's reverse shot, he's talking into a butt basically the whole time. Like, just a big ol' in-profile butt.
But what? Everyone I know has a big butt.
And it is perfectly in focus because he's standing right next to him.
Yeah.
And it's sort of hard to concentrate on anything else besides the idea that Geordi is speaking into a butt as if it were a microphone, and it's just right there.
That guy's kind of thrusting his pelvis in right into the computers, too.
Yeah, yeah, so you're aware of the scene I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, you gotta clear that.
Looking at it right now.
Gotta clear that background, guys. What do we have coming up on the next episode, Ben?
The next episode is season 5, episode 13, The Masterpiece Society. Picard's efforts to save a genetically engineered society from a natural disaster threaten to destroy it. Oh, I love it when there's grammar errors in these. Do you remember this episode, Adam?
You know, every time I say this, I get a ton of shit from people. Every time I say I don't remember an episode, invariably a couple people email in and they're like, in the very first episode of your podcast, you said you had a forensic memory for every episode of this show. So we know that that's bullshit.
So if you don't remember this, people will want to email drunkshimoda@gmail.com to tell us about how Adam lied in the first episode of our show.
I have set up a Gmail filter for the word forensic, and so that just goes straight into the garbage.
Does that also coincide with our one that says that filters for why didn't you say?
Yeah, why didn't you say is a part of it, and also you forgot to mention. That's a third rule.
God, we got so many why didn't yous about Max Headroom. So many.
I was shocked to know that the Venn diagram circles of Max Headroom fans and Greatest Generation viewers are two perfectly overlapping circles.
Yeah.
What the fuck? I was not expecting that at all.
20,000 people emailed us about why we didn't say anything about the fucking Max Headroom thing.
How about this? Because I didn't care. I knew about it. I just didn't care.
Oh my God, we heard so many times.
Wow. A lot of Headroom fans. What do you call those fans?
I don't know. I'm not really, like, I don't really think I even know what Max Headroom is, Adam.
I know, but I don't care.
I don't want to be run out of town on a rail or anything, but I just don't know.
You know what? If that's the rail that I'm run out of town on, so be it. Jeez. The militant Max Headroom fandom out there. God, give it a rest.
Unfortunately, Adam, we do not have vetoes left in our quiver, and thus this episode you remember nothing of.
This is going to feel like watching a brand new one. That's always fun.
Yeah, that's nice. It's like they're still making the show.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that'll be next time. Thanks to everybody that goes to iTunes and leaves us a nice review. That's really kind and thoughtful of you. Thanks to the great folks at Maximum Fun for all the support they provide. Thank you to MaxFunStore.com for having three great merchandise items from our show. You've got your West Hot American Summer t-shirt, your Drunk Shimoda t-shirt, and the all-new Drunk Shimoda Bar and Grill pint glass. I just added two of these to my cupboard, Adam.
Yeah, I just got mine in the mail, too. Very well packed. No chance really of breakage.
Yeah, and the shipping didn't go up when I added a second one to my order, so I thought that was pretty classy.
You know how sometimes you get like a like sort of a garbagey pint glass from somewhere, and it's like the screen print is a little thin and flaky, and the glass isn't that cool? I was really happy to see that this seems like a pretty quality glass set up.
Yeah, this is you know, ready for prime time. Like, you could actually deploy this glass in a bar and grill and not be worried about them getting shattered all the time, you know?
Someone could retroactively open up a Shimoda's Bar and Grill and buy nothing but these glasses. They're ready for restaurant use.
They're ready to go. They're not those cheapos that are going to break on you.
Yeah.
Anyways. The
You almost started a rant.
I almost started a rant about cheap glassware, Adam, but I'm not going to do it.
Save that for your other show.
Go to letsdrinkabout.it for my upcoming signature cheap glassware rant.
Glassrants.biz.
You can chat with us about the show on Twitter using the hashtag GreatestGen. Adam is at CutForTime. I'm at Benjamin R-A-H-R. There's a great Facebook group and also a great subreddit for the show. And, of course, the Maximum Fun subreddit is there as well. So, with that, we will be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek The Next Generation and a brand new episode of The Greatest Generation that you don't remember viewing the first time.
Wow, so that was our first episode with almost zero jokes at all in it. Good job by us.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.